couple little details. I've got to leave right after I finish here. I'm going to dash. I got to go to my next stop, so forgive me for not being able to say goodbye to each of you personally. I'll just kind of say, you know, see here, there, in the air. And we'll do that. And if you're interested in stuff, there's just a few books left. And if you want stuff that's not there, there'll be some order sheets. Bob, did you get those? They'll be there? Yeah. So there's some order sheets, and Kathy Irene's going to take care of that. The table, right, Kathy? Where are you? Yeah, Kathy Irene's got that covered over there. So I'll take care of that. And if you want me to speak at your church, I do Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night. That's what I do. That's how I survive. And so you can pick up a brochure or something and take care of that. Is that it? Okay, that's it. That's a piano over there. A couple possibilities about that piano. It may be the result of a random catastrophic atmospheric catastrophe. Well, no, it might be. I mean, here comes this twister. It knocks down this tree. The tree hits the rock, splits off a couple hunks of wood. The wood gets caught up in the funnel cloud, and it's being shaped, fashioned, formed purely at random. Now, while that's happening, some volcanic action occurs, and these little fissures happen, and this stuff comes squirting out of the ground. Whacked off at various lengths and caught up in this funnel cloud. Now, while that's going on, these little spinner jobbers come from someplace. Well, ring. I don't know where they came from. I haven't figured that out yet, but they embed themselves in the wood, and the wires go, and some shellac comes blowing by. Some steel wool, you know. And while that's all going on, this elephant happens on the scene. And he goes, rink, 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 and the lightning, lightning, and the thunder, thunder. You had emerged from that holocaust. Ta-da! A piano. What do you think? Well, you know, it might have happened that way. I can't prove to you it didn't happen that way. Just let me give you another option that's just a little easier to buy. Never seen him, touched him, or smelt him. Wouldn't recognize him if I passed him on the street. But if I had to bet, and I do, I'm betting there's a piano maker. That's not terribly profound, but as you sit here, you understand that given two options, that the piano happened by chance or somebody made it, wouldn't you conclude somebody made it? All right, now I'm not very bright. I'm an old athlete. But I'm more complex than the piano. And it's just, I cannot believe that some lightning hit some moves and made use. You know, I just have a lot of trouble with that because Kenny Poor's formula is a great one. Nothing plus nobody equals everything. I mean, it just doesn't work because of what I call the law of the sales squirrel. Second law of thermodynamics, it's the law of the sales squirrel. You run over a squirrel in the road, it doesn't get better. It gets flatter and flatter and drier, and pretty soon you pick it up, sail it. It's a frisbee. It is a sail squirrel. See, meat rots, fruit spoils, I'm getting old, I got a chicken neck. Nothing winds up. Everything winds down. Now, why would somebody come up with the idea that everything winds up when we've never observed it? Because when you take God out of the equation, you can now be your own God. And that's the motive behind the whole thing. You take God out of the equation, you're now free to do your own thing. I've concluded something. I think I told you this the other night. When the experts tell me one thing, and it's contrary to the book, the experts have been wrong enough, I've decided to go with the book. Billy Graham was struggling early on in his ministry. He went to a Forest Home Conference Center in Southern California, spent a week. And he had to decide whether or not he was going to make the book his authority for life. To not pick and choose, but to make his life's decisions based upon the book. And he finished that week at Forest Home and said, "This will be my authority." And his ministry took off. Some of you are still reading your Bibles like this. Judas hung himself. Go and do thou likewise. Whatsoever thou do it quickly. Well, you can get in trouble reading your Bibles that way. I recommend you stop picking and choosing and make that point in time, lifetime decision. I'm going to make my life decisions according to the book. It's not been wrong. I've had my moments of being wrong. So when what I think isn't right and it conflicts with the Bible, okay, I'm going to go with the book. I've been wrong long enough not to trust. If you were in South Dakota and you had a whiteout snowstorm and you decided to walk to safety, do you know what you'd find in about an hour? Your own footprints. So everybody has one leg that's slightly shorter than the other. And everybody, if you walk without a frame of reference, everybody walks in a circle. Did you know that? Pilots. I was talking to a trainer of pilots. And I said, how do you take a dominant, decisive personality type when he feels he's level, but in a whiteout kind of snowstorm, or a whiteout cloud when you fly into a cloud? Did you know that as a private pilot, if you fly into a cloud and you don't have navigational equipment, you have, on the average, 12 to 18 minutes to come out of the cloud? And if you don't come out of the cloud in 12 to 18 minutes, you'll usually hit the ground. Because when you don't have any navigational equipment, you can be in a downward spiral and the centrifugal force duplicates gravity and you think you're level, but you're not. You cannot maintain staying level without, if you're in a homemade plane that doesn't have equipment in it, you got to get out of that cloud within 12 minutes or you crash. But you think you're level. And so I said, how do you take these dominant decisive personalities who think one thing, but the instruments say another? How do you get them to trust the instruments? They say, we don't worry about that all that much because they weed themselves out rather quickly. See? I mean, I've learned that I can't be trusted. Have you learned that yet? You can't be trusted. So I've decided that when what I think is right is in conflict with the book, I've decided to make this my standard for making life's decision. That becomes an incredibly important concept when you deal with the issue of hell. Because every fiber of my being is repulsed by the concept. I do not understand why a loving God would create the place in the to begin with. I mean, why? I don't know. I guess perfect love requires perfect justice. I don't know. I have learned God doesn't do the sending. I assume I'm a star basketball player. High school. I'm out with this young lady, and it's 9:30, and curfew's 10. If I break curfew, I have to run 20 laps. But I need a little more time. I don't think she's going to kiss me goodnight. I need a little more time. And so I'll have to go past 10 o'clock, you know. And I know what it feels like to run 20 laps, but I don't know what it feels like to kiss this young lady. So I show up at practice next day, and the coach says, "Cardi, judging by the smile on your face, you broke curfew last night." I say, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Okay, well, don't stand there talking. Start running." Now, who made the rules? Coach, who broke the rules? I did. So who decided he would run 20 laps? I did. All right, so who makes the rules of life? God, who breaks them? Not me. You know, you too. This is not a you do. No. I'm not taking that weight. No way, baby. So if God makes the rules and I intentionally break them, who does the sending? Don't see God as sending people to hell. He created the place for folks who didn't want to make him his God. It's a place for folks who don't want God to be their God. It's a place where they go and be their own God. And you turn everybody loose with their sin nature turned loose in a place where there's nothing but open, unmitigated selfishness along with all the rest of the characteristics of the place, and you've got hell. So God didn't do the sending. But I still struggle with it. I'm going to have loved ones there, folks. I wrote that book, Playing the Odds, because I had shared Christ with my dad so much that he was getting upset and I was hurting the relationship. So I couldn't talk about it anymore with him. But he was always proud I wrote a book. So I said, hey, Dad, if I write a book, would you proofread the manuscript? He said, yeah, I will. And so I wrote all the things that I wanted to tell him and put them in that book. And I had to get creative in my presentation style. Now, he hadn't made that decision yet. He's 81. Do you have friends that are going to be there? You have loved ones going to be there? Me too. How do you deal with that? The only way you deal with that is going to denial. And I'm not talking about a river in Egypt. No, the policeman comes to the door. Mr. Carter, your son was just killed in a car wreck. What's your first response? There must be some mistake. Instant denial. I, too, have had my first encounter with the C word. I was moving this plant, bumped myself right here, and I said, ooh, ah, ooh, and then there was a squishy mass down underneath there. And I said, that's not right, you know? And I said, man, do men get breast cancer? And I went to the doctor and he said, yeah, they do. Only 5% of them are malignant, but when they're malignant, they're 95% fatal. So it's Friday. It's coming out next Friday. I'm on my way to Seattle. I wrote an article on my computer while I was writing, will I be sleepless in Seattle? You know, as I'm confronted with my mortality. And I come back for the operation, but my doctor couldn't be there, and so I had a lady doctor. Now, I don't have any problem with a lady doctor, but this one was clearly a feminist. I knew she was because she sewed my nipple on crooked to get even. So, I'm a little scary around the swimming pool now, you know, just not quite right. I mean, I spent the whole week in denial, right? I'm too healthy to have cancer. All right, so you understand, we instantly go into denial. And here's proof positive. 92% of the population believe in God. 66% of the population believe in heaven. This is in the United States. 46% of the population believe they're going to heaven. 53% of the population do believe in a concept called hell. 53. 4% believe they're going there. That's right. That's the number. And Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, many will go the broad way, few go the narrow way. The word many means a great number. You contrast it with the word few, that makes many a statement of majority. Jesus said more people will go to hell than won't. And 4% think they're going there. Now, if you had to bet, you're going with Jesus' words or somebody's feeling? Well, I think you better go with Jesus' words. They've stood the test. So I can tell what you believe by what you do not by what you say. Isn't that right? I mean, what you say won't really tell me what you believe. I can tell what you believe by what plays out in your life. Let's say I'm my next door neighbor. It's 3 in the morning. Is that Cardi's house? Well, of course it is. Cardi's house is always out that window. What time is it? Well, it's 3. Is that smoke? Well, it is. It's coming out of the chimney. You think his roof's on fire? Or is it the chimney? Cardi's house might be on fire, but I don't think so. It's 3 in the morning. He'd be in there sleeping. If I wake him up and it's the chimney, he'll really be mad. I don't think I'll give him a call. I'll just go back to sleep. I'm pretty sure he'll be okay. A good neighbor? You want to live next to that guy? No, how about this guy? 3 in the morning, is that smoke? It is. It's Cardi's house. Well, it is. Cardi, I'm sure he's in there sleeping. And I can't tell if it's the chimney or the roof. 911. Yeah, we got a fire over here. Well, mate, I'm not sure it's a fire, but you better get over here and check it out because Cardi's in there. Good neighbor? Well, better than the other guy. How about this one? That's Cardi's house, man. It's 3 in the morning. I bet he's sawing logs. That's smoke. Is that the chimney? I can't tell. It might be the roof. Cardi's house might be on fire. 911, get over to Cardi's house. Might be a fire. I'm going to go wake him up. But you get here as soon as you can because you got to make sure. I got to make sure Cardi's okay. And I run across the lawn in the middle of the night in my tight whites. I throw myself against the door. Ah, deadbolted. So I dive through the plate glass window. I am now all cut up, dripping carpet blood on Cardi's white wool carpet as I run across the living room, dripping blood up the stairway, hollering, "Cardi, Cardi, get up. I think your house is on fire." Cardi says, "It's just the chimney." Is Cardi mad? Yeah, he is. For a little bit. And then he thinks about it. You know, I can fix the dent in my door. I can put a new window in. I can have the carpet cleaned. But where am I going to find a neighbor who loves me like that? Somebody really cares, huh? I'm really glad to live next to that guy. And it's sure worth the expense having him next there, isn't it? Yeah, because next time there might be a real fire. And I can count on him to come to my rescue. He's already proved that he cares. Some of you are guests this weekend. And you've spent the weekend listening to this turn or burn, flip or fry, change your stroke or go down in smoke, hellfire and brimstone kind of preacher. When you first heard that that's the kind of preacher I was, you might have been thinking, does my neighbor think the person who invited me? I mean, you might have been a little uptight because now you're thinking they must think I'm not a nice person. I mean, they want to make sure I don't go to hell. They must think I'm a bad person because only bad people go to hell. Nice people don't go to hell, do they? And by now you understand that if this whole deal is real, going or not is based on an issue of relationship, not how good or bad you are, because we're all onions. And if you're still here, if you haven't bolted and gone home, you must have come to the conclusion, my friend must really care about me. I don't know for sure if I'm going to buy into this whole deal, but there is one thing for certain for sure, my friend must really care about me. Because they cared so much that they put the relationship on the line to make sure that I heard these truths. Yeah, that's a good friend. I was on a raft rally. 260 high school people on the Deschutes River in Central Oregon. We would take 2-man rafts and put 4 or 5 people in them. They'd have a life jacket and an oar. And we were going to raft on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Friday, then we would go out to Deschutes, to the mouth of the Columbia, come out at the park that's there, load the buses, and go back to Portland. I was the speaker for that, and you had a lot of kids who didn't know Christ, because here are the rules. You can come and go on the raft rally, but you have to sit through the meetings. Well, they're more than happy to sit through the meetings to be able to go on the raft rally. They don't want to, but they would. So it's Sunday night, and I've got 260 of them, and I have one spotlight in my face. We're in an old rodeo fairground in a little tiny town, so you got the wooden steps with the wooden outcropping to keep the rain off if it rained, and you're camped out in the center amongst the cow pies. So I'm going to speak, and I have a spotlight, and it's pitch black, so I can't see a thing. I mean, it is really dark, and I can't even see the front row, so there's no way I can do any crowd control with my eyes, or, you know, because I can't see a thing. I can just hear them rustling, you know, and there are shadows crisscrossing my face from the bugs, the crossing the light, the moth. What's more than one moth? What's a plural moth? Mothuses? Okay. So I got mothuses crisscrossing. I got elbows. I got people sneaking into the bushes. They're crawling into the rafters, you know. It is bedlam. All right, now it's Monday. We're going rafting. Now, in Western Oregon, you don't see the sun for about 10 months. And so you take people who haven't seen the sun for 10 months, and you put them on the water in the sun all day. They rust. You understand what happens to them. They become lobsters, and then you bring them home. Now they're all sunburned and exhausted, and then you feed them. And half of them go to sleep, and then the other half are wired. You know, and now I'm supposed to speak to them. Now you put a spotlight in my face with mothruses, putting shadows across my face, and kids elbowing each other, and they're sneaking in the bushes, they're climbing. It's bedlam. All right, Tuesday, leadership says, okay, Jay, it's an in-house play day, and we want you to do an altar call tonight. Give the kids a chance to receive Christ. I say, you're nuts. You say, what? Yeah, they don't even know my name. We have not connected yet. We are nowhere. The meetings are chaos. He says, well, whoever does come to Christ, we want to work with them the rest of the week, so have an altar call. Okay. It's Tuesday night. I got a spotlight. I got mothies. I got elbows. I got bushes. I got bedlam. They're in the rafters. Till about halfway through. And halfway through, something happened. It's never happened to me since, and it had never happened to me before, but God literally came on the place. You could tell. The mothuses stopped flying. The kids snuck in from the bushes. Climbed down from the rafters. No empty seats. Everybody wanted to be sitting next to someone. Kids who didn't know Christ were stone silent because God was there and you couldn't say anything in His presence. Everybody was in awe. And you didn't have to be a believer to know God was there. I mean, God was just there. And I shut up. 52 kids and forward. That's not a giant number, but here's the giant number. It's been 13 years. And as of last count, 30 of those kids are in full-time service around the world. It was an incredible event, but George didn't come forward. Scott had brought him. Scott was 5'10", 260. 4% body fat. Walking manhole cover, you know. And George was a good guy, but Scott was absolutely convinced George was going to hell. And he brought him. George didn't get saved. Scott didn't know what to do. He was frustrated. Next day, I'm in the raft with Scott and George. Now, you got to picture this. It is a two-man raft. 260, 200, I'm 230, this guy's 190. We got about this much raft out of the water. And we're paddling a submarine, you know? I mean, it is just ridiculous. And we're lining up for a major whitewater run. And I hear Scott say to George, hey, George, you never know when something might happen. Person ought to be ready. And he throws him out of the boat. Here comes the boat. Here comes old George. And we paddle over to the still water. He hadn't bumped his head or anything. He's got a life jacket on, so he's fine. And we paddle over to him. He's sputting and spitting a little. And Scott reaches down and one hands him into the boat like a 264% body fat guy can do. And he looks him right in the face and says, "See what I mean?" Now, we couldn't tell how he said it, and we didn't know how George took it. All I know is they didn't speak to each other the rest of the day. And we were afraid to turn around and look at him, and we were afraid to even ask him any questions. We spent the whole rest of the day in stone silence, looking straight ahead, and the only time you heard anybody say was, "Paddle right, paddle left, paddle right," nobody said anything else. Got to camp that night, and leadership said, "Jay, we want to do a communion service. Can you do a communion service? We got 52 kids who've never had it properly." I said, "Well, sure, I can do a communion service. Did anybody bring the elements?" "No, but maybe you could figure something out." So I went to the cook shack, and I found a box of Kicks. Six packs of Welch's grape soda. And 10 o'clock at night, we had a cigarette. Well, they weren't Episcopalians. We didn't need bells and smells. I thought Kicks had worked just fine, you know. We finished up about 10:30, and everybody left, and there's Scott and there's George. Scott says, "Jay, George would like to receive Christ. Would you lead us? It would really mean a lot to me if you'd lead us in communion, the three of us. Would you do that?" "You bet." About 11 o'clock at night, old George joined the family of God. You know why, don't you? Because Scott had earned the right to throw him out of the boat. It's one thing to stand on the street corner and scream or put John 3:16 on a TV camera at a ball game. You'll never see the person again. But to earn the right to throw him out of the boat, to earn the right to bring someone you dearly love to a conference, to earn the right to throw him out of the boat. Now that's... See, I can tell what you believe by what you do, not by what you say. I'm going to need some help. Oh, you understand the value of a soul? Well, let me help you understand the value of a life. Life insurance companies will currently insure a homemaker for $1.5 million. That's what you're worth to your family. Did you know that? You're worth $1.5 million. Some corporate executives are worth $7 million. Now, if you were to boil your body down into its elements, you're currently worth about $7.93. I'm worth a little more than you are. So life in the United States must be the difference between $7.93 and $1.5 million to $7 million. But life, understand it, is like pork bellies. It's a commodity. And commodities vary in value according to market circumstances. Let me prove it to you. If you're born female in China in the outer provinces, they're only allowed one child. They tend to kill the female until they get a male. See, females in the outer provinces of China aren't worth much. It is so bad that it is now almost 70% men and 30% women, and they're having trouble finding wives. If you're born in India, the cow is worth as much as you are. You don't kill the spider, might be your uncle. Don't step on the ant, might be your aunt. Wherever you have pestilence, lots of people, and poverty, life's not worth much. 5 to 7 mil. I'm telling you, life is valued like a commodity. You strand a few whales in the Arctic, we'll spend millions to save them because there aren't very many whales, but there are an awful lot of people. And the more older people you get, we'll have to figure out a way to kill them. We're working on that now. Kevorkian's working hard at that. Got to figure out how to kill them because there'll be so many of them. See, the more you get, the less they're worth. It's life. There are economic considerations. If you're born less than 2 pounds at Brown University, they will let you die. Because it costs more to save a less than 2 pound preemie than that preemie will generally earn in its lifetime, and it's generally not considered cost effective. So they only try to save 2 pounds or heavier. Life value changes. It has value according to economic considerations as well as supply and demand. And then there are relationship considerations. What's your name? Carol? It's been great having you in the front row. Good smile. Been cheering me on. I like you. I think you're terrific. I have a daughter about your age, I think. And I like her more. But I like you. But I like my daughter more. You understand? Are you offended? No, you understand, right? What's your name? You. Paul? You're great. I like my son better, though. You know, I just do. Yeah. What's your name? Judy. I like my wife better than you. You like your wife better than my wife, Jerry?
Yeah,
better. I'm thrilled to give you 3 days of my life. Wouldn't trade my kids for any of you. Oh, I wouldn't trade my kids for all of you. I've thought it through. If terrorists came in and said, Cardi, it's Mike, you give me your kid or I'm going to kill everybody in the room. You're dead meat. There was this family, husband, wife, a junior high boy, elementary school daughter. They were walking along, and the junior high boy was picking on the daughter. Next scene, the boy steps off a curb, car hits him. Next scene, they're in the hospital, doctor's talking to the parents. Your son has a very rare blood type. We don't have any at the hospital. We've sent for some, but we need a transfusion from the daughter who has the same blood type as her brother. Next scene, parents talking to the little girl. Your brother needs a transfusion. Would it be okay? She thinks back to her brother picking on her and says, let me think about it. Next scene, she says, okay. And the next scene puts two gurneys with a red tube connecting the two. And after a few moments, the little girl sits up with a perplexed look on her face and says, Mommy, when do I die? You see, she thought she had to give all her blood. She didn't know what a transfusion was, and it took her a moment to think that through. There's the bus. It's teetering on the cliff. It's about to fall. You've got time for one trip. Somebody else's kids are in the front seat. Your kids are in the second seat. It'll be easier to save these. Will you bypass those in the first seat and go get yours? Without apology. Why? Because value of life varies according to relationship. You with me on this? It's cold, hard facts, folks. Right? And it values according to potential and productivity. Pardon my language, but if I had to make a choice between Billy Graham and some puke of a Hell's Angel, I'd go with Billy. You understand? I'd go with Billy. And if you had to choose between a white-collar criminal and a serial rapist chainsaw massacre dude, I'd go with the white-collar criminal. I'll do it on, I'll value life on how good or bad you are, your potential and your productivity. I will do it on relationship, supply and demand, and economics. And you will too, right? Because that's the way you value life. But how does God value souls? Jesus died for lives or souls? Gave his life to die for souls and put equal value on each one. None of those other variables affect the value of a soul. Whatever Christ is worth to God the Father, that is the value of a soul. You got it? Which one lasts longer? Life or soul? Which one's more valuable? Help me with this one. I'm going to need your help. Star Trek II, The Wrath of... Thank you. Khan is in the disabled ship. He hates Kirk. Captain James T. Kirk, that's correct. Of the starship. Kirk's won again. Khan can never beat him. I mean, Kirk is his nemesis, you know. In the course of the battle, the Enterprise has lost its warp drive. All it has is impulse power. But Khan is totally shot up, see. But he has the Genesis device. And if he pushes the button, 4 minutes, huge explosion, Khan will be vaporized. He doesn't care if he commits suicide. He doesn't care. He wants to kill Kirk. And without warp drive, they'll never escape the shockwave. So if he pushes the button, he'll kill Kirk. He pushes the button. In the Enterprise, the engine room is so filled with radiation that anybody who went in to fix it would die before they could complete the repairs. That is, anybody who has red blood. But Spock's blood's not red, it's
green.
Because he's a... Thank you. He doesn't argue. He leaves the bridge and runs down to the engine room. And on the other side of the plexiglass wall is the radiation that will kill him. And we don't have a problem with that. Everybody knows that plexiglass holds in radiation. So he goes on the other side and starts working on the warp drive, see? And, you know, he's dying. He's getting radiation sores. He's groveling, sniveling. He fixes it just as the shockwave, kaboom, Khan's toast. Here comes the shockwave. He fixes it. Kirk shifts it into warp. They patch out ahead of the shockwave, and everybody's safe, except Spock. He's dying. And Kirk leaves the bridge and runs down to the engine room, and there's Spock groveling, sniveling, covered with radiation sores. And Spock holds up his hand and pushes against the plexiglass. And he says, live long and
prosper.
Isn't it fun? Some of you are sitting there, I never dreamed so many knew all those answers. And Kirk puts his hand against the plexiglass and says, prosper and live long. And it's an almost touching moment. And then Kirk asked him a question. He said, why'd you do it? And Spock's a Vulcan, so he's logical. He says, well, Captain, Admiral by then, if you're, you know, a Trekker, Trekkies are, you know, passe, it's Trekker. When it comes to life and death, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And Kirk adds, or the one, meaning Spock. See, it's a military answer. If you're a general, you got 200 lives at stake, and you have to spend two lives to save 200, it's an easy call. Unless you're one of the two. All right. So Spock understood, everybody's going to die, including me, if through my death, since I'm going to die anyhow, I can save everybody else. That's logical. Let's do it. End of the movie, it was hokey. Scotty played bagpipes, Amazing Grace. It wasn't good. They cleaned the innards out of a photon torpedo, stuffed Spock's body in it, put in the body parts, sealed the lid, and shot him down to the Genesis planet. Movie ends. All right. Star Trek III. In search of... Takes a lot more makeup to make Kirk's face look young. What's the similarity to his face in a ski slope? 10 inches of base, 2 inches of powder. He's at his condo outside of Federation headquarters in San Francisco. There's a knock at the door. It's Sarak, full-blooded Vulcan, Spock's dad. See, Spock is half Vulcan, half human. Sarak is the ambassador to the Federation from the planet Vulcan. And you need to know, never in recorded history has a Vulcan ever told a lie. I mean, what are the odds that the next words out of a Vulcan's mouth are going to be a lie if in the course of recorded history they've never told one? I mean, don't you think you can trust a Vulcan? Yeah. So I have this conversation. I'm paraphrasing for the sake of time. Why'd you do it? Why'd I do what? Why'd you bury my kid on the Genesis planet? Well, he died there. Seemed like a good place to bury him. Didn't he tell you? Tell me what? He would have told someone, it's too important. Tell me what? You mean he didn't tell you? No, actually told McCoy through a Vulcan mind meld and nobody knew. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it doesn't matter. Listen, Vulcan, Spock would have told you, Vulcans have to be returned to their home planet. Their bodies do, or they spend eternity in a timeless void, your Earth equivalent of hell. That's why there aren't many Vulcans in Starfleet, because when we leave our planet, we risk alienation, total condemnation. We risk timelessness. And he would never have done that. He would have told someone, return his body. Are you kidding me? Vulcans don't kid. That's right. You're always so serious all the time. Did Kirk believe him? Well, how do you know? By what he did, not by what he said. Let me tell you what he did. He went to Federation headquarters and said, I need to borrow the Enterprise. I got to get Spock out of hell. They said, I'm sorry. It's a violation of church and state. You can't have it. So he goes and tells his friends, Spock's in hell. What? Far out. Weird. Are you kidding? How do you know? Sarek said so. Oh. Vulcan's never told a lie. He must be in hell. Well, did they believe? See, if you believe something, you'll tell your friends, right? Kirk told his friends. Did his friends believe him? Yeah, why'd they believe him? Sarek never had told a lie. No Vulcan ever has. So, well, let me tell you what they did. They risked court-martial, dishonor, jail. They risked death fighting Klingons. They stole this. They stole the Enterprise, low security deal. Scotty sabotaged the Excelsior, the only ship in the galaxy that could catch him, and Kirk's son was killed by a Klingon. And Kirk concluded, I think my son's soul is okay. We didn't have enough information to know that. But he thought his son's soul was okay. And he knew Spock's soul wasn't okay. And so Kirk concluded, if it takes the life of my son, whose soul is okay, to save the soul of my best friend that's not okay, as long as I know my son's soul is okay, tough call, good trade. You don't want to get your theology from the movies. That's pretty dangerous. And what I'm about to say would make Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, roll over in his grave, a devout humanist. But at the end of the movie, they asked Kirk, why'd you do it? He said, when it comes to eternity, the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. When it's life and death, needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. When it's eternity, needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. And for the first time in my life, I understood the parable of the 99 sheep and one. Let me read it for you. It's Matthew 18, if you want to follow along. It starts in verse 12. Oh, what's your name?
Rich.
Rich, I'm big sheep man. Going on vacation. I'll give you 100 sheep to take care of, and I'll pay you very well. Will you take care of them for me? Say yes, I'm in trouble on time. Yes. Here's the deal. If one of those dumb little suckers wanders away, don't leave the 99, go looking for the one. You might not even find the one, and who knows what you find when you come back. Wolves, rustlers, coyotes, you know, might take them all. So maybe the one will come back, maybe it won't. If it doesn't, I don't care, at least I'll have 99. So I will pay you very well if one of those stupid sheep walks away and I only have 99 when I get back. Do you understand? Okay, now let's read that. What do you think? If any man has 100 sheep, one of them's gone astray, doesn't he leave the 99 on the mountains and go and search for the one that's straying? Not me! That doesn't make any sense as a businessman. That's stupid. Not me. I'm not going to do that. All right, verse 13. If it turns out that he finds it, truly I say to you, rejoices over it more than the 99 which have not gone astray. Not me. I'm going to beat that sheep within an inch of its life. I may kill it just to make sure it doesn't have a chance to walk away. As a matter of fact, if I am a shepherd, I am going to break that sheep's leg, reset it, carry it over my shoulder until it can walk again, and my heartbeat will so bond it with the sheep that that sheep will never again leave my side. That's what a shepherd does with a wandering sheep. It's just not making sense. Thus, it's not the will of your Father in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Oh. Here's the deal. The 99 sheep are secure in Christ. The 99 sheep are saved. The 99 sheep are born again. The one sheep isn't, and God just placed value on that unsaved person. He said if it takes 99 Christians, if it takes the lives of 99 believers to save one lost soul, God says that's a good trade. And you now have the principle of mission. And if two concepts happen to collide for you this weekend, that there's nothing more valuable than a soul, and nice people really do go to hell, if those two concepts collide, your life cannot possibly be the same, and it now has meaning and purpose that goes beyond the day-to-day making of money and survival in a family setting. Car just crashed on the freeway. EMT, there you are. Oh, she's trapped in there, and the carburetor flares. It got a fire. You put it together, 2 minutes, the car will be engulfed in flames. You've seen it before. You know what's going to happen. Are you panicky to get her out of there? You get the jaws out and the whole deal. The bigger the fire gets, the more panic you get, right? Because you know she's going to die right in front of you. Now you know that. Right? I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on you. I just want you to understand, we all count lives as more valuable than souls. Because you'll spend more effort getting her out of the car than you will getting your neighbor here next year. Because you're not sure your neighbor's really going to go to hell. You're just not sure about that one. And you know about the fire. And I can tell what you believe by what you do, not by what you say. And if you really believe a place like hell exists, your life cannot stay the same. If you really believe that. To learn to worship God, to understand that nice people go to hell, and that there's nothing more valuable than a soul, that will give you what you need to finish well. I was in Hawaii at a marathon. It was a triathlon. I was in an aid station. I wasn't in it. And Julie Moss had finished the swim in first place. She wasn't a good biker. She fell to sixth place at the bike. She had recaptured first place in the run. It's a 2.4-mile swim. It's a 126-mile bike ride, and it's a 26.4-mile run. She had recaptured first place in the run when she hit the wall, 200 yards from the finish. She was incontinent, diarrhea running down her legs. She was disoriented from no fluids. She collapsed on the ground. People came to help her, and she said, "No, don't touch me," because if they touched her, she would be disqualified. She crawled to her knees, and she crawled towards the finish line. And her knees were bloody, and the palms of her hands were bloody, and she got to her feet kind of, and she went along kind of monkey style as best she could, and she got to her feet, and 15 feet from the finish line, she collapsed again. And she couldn't get to her feet, and she couldn't get to her knees, and she crawled. And footsteps came behind her, and she was passed. She now would not finish first, but she was intent on finishing. She crawled, blood, diarrhea, the rest, and crawled, and she collapsed on the finish line. The line was here. Her trunk was across, but her legs weren't. And she couldn't move, and so she reached down, and she grabbed a leg, and she pulled it across the line. And she grabbed the other leg, and she pulled it across the line. And people came to help her. And she said, "Am I across?" And they said, "Yes." And she allowed herself the luxury of unconsciousness. It's one of the greatest things I've ever experienced. So focused on the finish that even though she couldn't finish first, she would finish. And so doing, finished well, didn't she? She didn't finish first, but she finished well. If you finish the marathon, you've done it well. It's a triathlon. If you just finish, you get a t-shirt. It's my target. I want to finish well. I don't finish like David. No, he took a census to see how great he was and used a young virgin to keep him warm. Had a problem with the ladies all his life, didn't he? He probably stayed a virgin because he was too old to do anything about it. I believe that. Why didn't he use a hot rock? Hot rock could keep him warm. Used a young virgin. The guy was dysfunctional. You can tell because of his son. Had the same problem Dad had. Only made an art form out of it. 1,000 women in his life at the end of his life. Did not finish well, right? Known for the middle of his life. I don't want to be known for the middle of my life. Sure, I've written some books and some series. And I travel around and had some good ministry. But all of the middle goes away if you don't finish well. And my passion is to finish well. Don't care about the middle. I want to finish well. And you understand the motive for finishing well. To learn to love the Lord my God and to understand that my neighbor's soul is the most valuable thing going and nice people really do go to hell. And if those concepts come together, your life will never be the same. Not in the fire station, not in your neighborhood. Can't be the same. Can't be the same if the concepts collide. So I've done the best I could to communicate the concepts. That's as good as I can do. If you would be impassioned like Julie Moss to finish that race, and your motive is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and your neighbor is yourself, understanding that that neighbor as a soul that Christ died for, and just being nice won't solve that neighbor's problem. You'll go back home forever different, not just having had a temporary mountaintop experience, but absolutely forever different. Let's pray. Father, that you would communicate the value of a soul, the value of your son to yourself. We now have that value. And the harsh reality that nice people who want to be their own God will be separated from God forever. May our passion for you in worship and our understanding of those truths and our love for our neighbor forever change us. May it be so. In Jesus' name. Today. Amen. Amen. Bob?
Jake Hardy's mailing address is 1735 Northwest Arthur Circle in Corvallis, Corvallis, Oregon. Zip is 97330. Jake's telephone number is in area code 503. His number is 754-7547.